where you already are, and you need to remind yourself to just be with the breath in the present moment. Paradoxically, as we have seen, this is the most effective way to get somewhere and to nurture relaxation, calmness, concentration, and insight. They will come by themselves in time if you keep up the daily discipline and practice according to these guidelines. In weeks 5 and 6, the people in the stress reduction clinic alternate a 45-minute sitting one day with the yoga practice the next. If you aren't doing the yoga, then you might like to alternate the sitting with the body scan during these weeks, or to just sit every day. This is also a good time to start practicing some walking meditation. To encourage self-directed practice, during week 7 in the stress reduction clinic, the participants in the MBSR program stop using the CDs for guidance for a week and continue to practice on their own, devoting a total of 45 minutes per day to a combination of sitting, yoga, and body scanning. It's up to them to decide on the mix. We encourage them to experiment, perhaps by using 2 or even 3 of the techniques together on the same day, say 30 minutes of yoga followed by 15 minutes of sitting, or 20 minutes of sitting followed by yoga either right after it or at another time of day entirely. In the 8th week, we return to using the guided mindfulness meditation practice CDs, choosing whichever practices you are drawn to, and practicing every day for a total of 45 minutes at a stretch. The 8th week being the end of the program and of our formal recommendations for practice is also the first week of practicing on your own. We tell our patients that the 8th week lasts the rest of their lives. We see it as a beginning much more than an ending. The practice doesn't end just because we've stopped telling you what to do. By this point, you will be firmly in the driver's seat yourself, and one would hope, if you've been practicing in a regular, disciplined way, you will certainly have enough skill and experience to keep up the momentum you've developed to guide your own mindfulness practice. Of course, you can continue, as many people do, to use the CDs for guidance and reinforcement. Most of us are not particularly sensitive to either our body or our thought processes. This becomes all too clear when we begin to practice mindfulness. We can be surprised at how difficult it is just to listen to the body or attend to our thoughts as events. When we work systematically to bring our undivided attention to the body, as we do when we practice the body scan or the sitting or the yoga, we are literally increasing our connectedness with it. We know our body better as a result. We trust it more, we read its signals more accurately, and we know how good it can feel to be completely at one with our body in a state of deep relaxation. We also learn to regulate its level of tension intentionally in ways that are not possible without awareness. The same is true for our thoughts and feelings and for our relationship to the environment. When we are mindful of the process of thought itself, we can more readily catch our own lapses of mind, the inaccuracies of our thinking, and the self-subverting behaviors that often follow from them. As we've seen, the great delusion of separateness that we indulge in, coupled with our deeply conditioned habits of mind, the scars we carry, and our general level of unawareness, can result in particularly toxic and dysregulating consequences for both our body and our mind. The overall result is that we may feel deeply inadequate when it comes to facing and living within and changing the full catastrophe of our lives. On the other hand, the more conscious we are of the interconnectedness of our thoughts and feelings, our choices and our actions in the world, the more we can see with eyes of wholeness, the more effective we will be when faced with obstacles and challenges and stress. If we wish to mobilize our most powerful inner resources to help us to move toward greater levels of health and well-being, we will have to learn how to tap into them in the face of the sometimes blistering levels of stress that we live immersed in. Toward this end, we will examine what we mean by stress in the first place. We will look at the common ways we react to it, how stress can dysregulate our bodies and our very lives, and how we might make use of it to grow, to heal, and to come to peace within ourselves. The body has no monopoly on suffering. Emotional pain, the pain in our hearts and minds, is far more widespread and just as likely to be debilitating as physical pain. This pain can take many forms. There is the suffering of self-condemnation, such as when we blame ourselves for something we did or for something we didn't do, or when we feel unworthy or stupid and lack confidence in ourselves. If we caused other people hurt, we might also experience the pain of guilt, a combination of self-blame and remorse. There is pain in anxiety, worry, fear, and terror. There is pain in loss and grief, humiliation and embarrassment, despair and hopelessness. We may carry one kind of emotional pain or another deep within our hearts, often for much of our lives, like a heavy and sometimes secret burden, at times unknown even to ourselves. As with physical pain, our emotional pain is also trying to tell us something. It too is a messenger. Feelings have to be acknowledged, at least to ourselves. They have to be encountered and felt in all their force. There is simply no other way through to the other side of them. If we ignore our feelings and emotions, or repress them, or suppress them, or sublimate them, they fester and yield no resolution, no peace. And if we exaggerate them and dramatize them and preoccupy ourselves with their turmoil without any awareness of what we are doing, they also linger on and cause us to become stuck. Even in the tortured throes of grief or anger, in the gnawing remorse of guilt, in the slack tides of sadness and hurt, and in the swells of fear, it's still possible to be mindful, to know that in this moment I am feeling grief, I am feeling anger, I am feeling guilty or sad or hurt or frightened or confused. Strange as it may sound, the intentional knowing of your feelings in times of emotional suffering contains in itself the seeds of healing. Just as we saw with physical pain, that part of you that can know your feelings, that sees clearly what they are, that can accept them in the present, while they are happening, no matter what they are, in their full undisguised fury, if that is the case, or in their many disguises, such as confusion, rigidity, alienation, or despair, that awareness itself has an independent perspective that is outside of your suffering. It is not buffeted by the storms of the heart and of the mind. The storms still have to run their course. Their pain has to be felt. But they actually unfold differently when cradled in awareness. For one thing, they are no longer just happening to you like an outside force. You are now taking responsibility for feeling what you're feeling in this moment, because this is what is happening now in your life. These moments of pain are as much moments to be lived fully as are any others, and they can actually teach us a great deal, although few of us would seek out these lessons willingly. But relating to your pain consciously, as long as it is here anyway, allows you to be a participant with your feelings rather than a victim of them. No one who works in a hospital can be unmoved by the infinite variations of the full catastrophe that are encountered every day. Each person who comes to the stress reduction clinic has his or her own unique version. Not infrequently, our patients come feeling that not only their bodies, but their very lives are out of control. They feel overwhelmed by fears and worries. Many of the people who come to the stress reduction clinic have not seen much improvement in their physical condition, despite years of medical treatment. Yet by the time they have been in the program for a few weeks, the majority of these people are taking major steps toward transforming their relationship to their bodies and minds and to their problems. Although they were originally referred to the clinic to learn how to relax and to cope better with their stress, it is apparent that they've learned a lot more than that. They often leave with fewer and less severe physical symptoms and with greater self-confidence, optimism, and assertiveness. They are more patient with and more accepting of themselves and their limitations and disabilities. They are more confident about their ability to handle physical and emotional pain, as well as the other forces in their lives. They are also less anxious, less depressed, and less angry. They feel more in control, even in very stressful situations that previously would have sent them spinning out of control. In a word, they are handling the full catastrophe of their lives, the entire range of life experience, including impending death in some cases, much more skillfully. Usually, people leave the clinic thanking us for their improvement, but actually, the progress they make is entirely due to their own efforts. What they are really thanking us for is the opportunity to get in touch with their own inner strength and resources, and also for believing in them and not giving up on them, and for giving them the tools to make such transformations possible. This work involves, above all, the regular disciplined practice of moment-to-moment awareness, or mindfulness, the complete owning, if you will, of each moment of your experience, good, bad, or ugly. This is the essence of full catastrophe living. All of us have the capacity to be mindful. All it involves is cultivating our ability to pay attention in the present moment. One way to think of this process of transformation is to think of mindfulness as a lens, taking the scattered and reactive energies of your mind and focusing them into a coherent source of energy for living, for problem solving, and for healing. We routinely and unknowingly waste enormous amounts of energy in reacting automatically and unconsciously to the outside world and to our own inner experiences. Cultivating mindfulness means learning to tap and focus our own wasted energies. In doing so, we learn to calm down enough to enter and dwell in states of deep relaxation. This nourishes and restores body and mind. Cultivating mindfulness can lead to the discovery of deep realms of relaxation, calmness, and insight within yourself. Whether you are facing heart disease or cancer or pain or just a very stressful life, its energies can be of great value to you. The systematic cultivation of mindfulness has been called the heart of Buddhist meditation. It has flourished over the past 2,600 years in both monastic and secular settings in many Asian countries. In recent years, the practice of this kind of meditation has become widespread in the world. This audiobook is designed to introduce you, the listener, to the training program our patients undergo in the stress reduction clinic. However, anybody who is interested in achieving the kinds of results seen in the stress reduction clinic should understand that our patients make a strong commitment to practice the formal techniques as described in this audiobook on a daily basis for a period of at least 8 weeks. What you will be learning will be coming primarily from inside you, from your own experience as your life unfolds from moment to moment, rather than from any external authority or teacher or belief system. Our philosophy is that you are the world expert on your life, your body, and your mind, or at least you are in the best position to become that expert if you observe carefully. Part of the adventure of meditation is to use yourself as a laboratory to find out who you are and what you're capable of doing. As Yogi Berra once famously said, you can observe a lot by just watching. After perhaps a minute or two or three or four, either the body or the mind will have had enough and will demand something else, either to shift to some other posture or to do something else entirely. This is inevitable. It is at this point that the work of self-observation gets particularly interesting and fruitful. Normally, every time the mind moves, the body follows. If the mind is restless, the body is restless. If the mind wants a drink, the body goes to the kitchen sink or to the refrigerator. If the mind says this is boring, then before you know it, the body is up and looking around for the next thing to do to keep the mind happy. If you have been trying it, perhaps you will have already noticed that your mind tends to move around a lot. You may have contracted with yourself to keep your attention focused on the breath no matter what. But before long, you will undoubtedly find that the mind is off someplace else. It has forgotten the breath. It has been drawn away. Each time you become aware of this while you are sitting, you gently bring your attention back to your belly and back to your breathing, no matter what carried it away. If it moves off the breath 100 times, then you just calmly bring it back 100 times, as soon as you're aware of not being on the breath. By doing so, you are training your mind to be less reactive and more stable. By repeatedly bringing your attention back to the breath each time it wanders off, concentration builds and deepens, much as muscles develop by repetitively lifting weights. Working regularly with, rather than struggling against, the resistance of your own mind builds inner strength. At the same time, you are also developing patience and practicing being non-judgmental. You are not giving yourself a hard time because your mind left the breath. You simply and matter-of-factly return it to the breath, gently but firmly. As you will quickly see when you sit down to meditate, almost anything can carry your attention away from your breathing. One big source of distracting impulses is your body. As a rule, if you sit still for a while in any position, your body will become uncomfortable. Normally, we are continually shifting our position without much awareness of it in response to this discomfort. But when practicing meditation, it is actually useful to resist the first impulse to shift position in response to bodily discomfort. Instead, we direct our attention to these sensations of discomfort and mentally welcome them. Why? Because at the very moment they come into awareness, these sensations of discomfort become part of our present moment experience, and thus worthy objects of observation and inquiry in and of themselves. They give us the opportunity to look directly at our automatic reactions and at the whole process of what happens as the mind loses its balance and becomes agitated as it is drawn away from the breath. By sitting with some discomfort and accepting it as part of our experience in the moment, even if we don't like it, which we don't, we discover that it is actually possible to relax into physical discomfort. This is one example of how discomfort or even pain can be your teacher and help you to heal. Relaxing into discomfort sometimes reduces pain intensity. The more you practice, the more skill you can develop in reducing pain or at least becoming more transparent to it. But whether you experience pain reduction or not during the sitting meditation, intentionally working with your reactions to discomfort will help you to develop some degree of calmness and equanimity, qualities which will prove useful in facing many different challenges and stressful situations, as well as pain. In order for the meditation practice to take root in your life and flourish, you will have to know why you are practicing. How else will you be able to sustain non-doing in a world where only doing seems to count? What will get you up early in the morning to sit and follow your breathing when everybody else is snug in bed? What will motivate you to practice when the wheels of the doing world are turning, your obligations and responsibilities are beckoning, and a part of you decides or remembers to take some time for, quote, just being? What will motivate you to bring moment-to-moment awareness into your daily life? What will prevent your practice from losing energy and becoming stale, or from petering out altogether after an initial burst of enthusiasm, as so often happens? To sustain your commitment and keep your meditation practice fresh over a period of months and years, it is important to develop your own personal vision that can guide you in your efforts and remind you at critical times of the value of charting such an unusual course in your life. There may be times when your vision will be the only support you have in keeping up your practice. In part, your vision will be molded by your unique life circumstances, by your personal beliefs and values. Another part will develop from your experience of the meditation practice itself, from letting everything become your teacher, your body, your attitude, your mind, your pain, your joy, other people, your mistakes, your failures, your successes, nature, in short, all your moments. But still another element of your vision will have to come from your knowledge of the world and from your beliefs about where and how you fit into it. If your health is a major part of your motivation for coming to meditation practice, then your knowledge of and respect for your own body and how it works, your perspective on what medicine can and cannot do for you, and your understanding of the role of the mind in health and healing may be very important elements of your vision. The strength of your personal vision will depend in great measure on what you know in these areas and on how much you're willing to learn. As with the meditation practice itself, this kind of learning requires a lifelong commitment to continual inquiry and a willingness to modify your perspective as you acquire new knowledge and arrive at new levels of understanding and insight. In the Stress Reduction Clinic, we try to stimulate people to learn more about their own bodies and about the role of the mind in health and illness as a fundamental part of their adventure in growth and healing. The popular name for the full catastrophe nowadays is stress. Any concept that covers such a broad scope of life circumstances as does this particular term is bound to be somewhat complex. Yet, at its heart, the notion of stress is also very simple. It unifies a vast array of human responses into a single concept with which people strongly identify. As soon as I say to someone that my job is in stress reduction, the response is invariably, "Oh, I could really use that." People know exactly what it means, at least to them. To some extent, our ability to cope with stressors depends on how virulent they are. At one end of the spectrum are stressors that, if not avoided, will destroy life regardless of the way we perceive them. Among these are exposure to high levels of toxic chemicals or radiation or being hit by bullets that destroy vital organs. At the other end of the spectrum, there are many forces that impinge on us that almost nobody finds particularly stressful. For instance, we are all continually subjected to the gravitational pull of the Earth. Since gravity is always affecting us, we tend not to notice it. But if you work for 8 hours at a time standing in one place on a concrete floor, you will be very aware of gravity as a stressor. Of course, unless you are an iron worker, a steeple painter, a trapeze artist, or a ski jumper, gravity is usually the least of your stress problems. But it illustrates the point that some stressors are unavoidable and that we are continually adapting to the demands they place on our body. In the vast middle range of stressors, the general rule for those causing psychological stress is that how you see things and how you handle them makes all the difference in terms of how much stress you will experience. You have the power to affect the balance point between your internal resources for coping with stress and the stressors that are an unavoidable part of living. By exercising this capacity consciously and intelligently, you can control the degree of stress you wind up experiencing. Moreover, rather than having to invent a new way of dealing with every individual stressor that comes up in your life, you can develop a way of dealing with change in general, with problems in general, with pressures in general. The first step, of course, is recognizing when you are under stress in the first place. The late Dr. Richard Lazarus, a prominent stress researcher, and his colleagues working at the University of California at Berkeley, emphasized that perhaps the most fruitful way to look at stress from a psychological point of view is to consider it as a transaction between a person and his or her environment. Dr. Lazarus defines psychological stress as a particular relationship between the person and the environment that is appraised by the person as taxing or exceeding his or her resources and endangering his or her well-being. This means, as we have already discussed, that an event can be more stressful for one person who, for one reason or another, has fewer resources for dealing with it than for another person who has greater coping resources. It also implies that the meaning of the transaction will determine whether a situation is labeled as stressful or not. If you appraise or interpret an event as threatening your well-being, then it will be taxing to you. But if you see it differently, then the very same event might not be stressful at all, or a good deal less stressful to you. Mindfulness allows us to see more clearly into the nature of our pain. Sometimes it helps us to cut through confusion, hurt feelings, and emotional turmoil caused perhaps by misperceptions or exaggerations and our desire that things be a certain way. When you next find yourself in a period of suffering, try listening for a calm inner voice that might be saying, "Isn't this interesting? Isn't it amazing what a human being can go through? Amazing how much pain and anguish I can feel or create for myself or get bogged down in." In listening for a calm voice within your own heart, within your own pain, you will be reminding yourself to observe the unfolding of your emotions with wise attention, with a degree of non-attachment. You may find yourself wondering how things will finally be resolved, and knowing that you don't know, that you will just have to wait and see. Yet you can be certain that a resolution will come, that what you are experiencing is like the crest of a wave. It can't keep itself up indefinitely. It has to release. And you will know as well that how you handle what is going on at the crest of this wave can influence what the resolution will be. For instance, if in a fit of anger you say or do something that deeply harms another person, you have compounded the suffering of that moment even further and ensured that the resolution will be even further away and perhaps much less to your liking. So in moments of great emotional pain, perhaps you will come to accept not knowing how things will resolve in the present moment, and in that acceptance, begin the process of healing. You may discern within your pain, even as you feel it, that some of it is coming from non-acceptance, from rejecting what has already happened, or what was said or done, from wanting things to be some other way, more to your liking, more under your control. Perhaps you would like another chance. Perhaps you want to turn back the clock and do something differently, or say something you didn't, or take back something you did. Perhaps you are jumping to conclusions without knowing the whole story and feeling hurt unnecessarily because of your own premature reactions to things. There are many ways in which we suffer, but usually they are variations on a few basic patterns. If you are mindful as emotional storms occur, perhaps you will see in yourself an unwillingness to accept things as they already are, whether you like them or not. Perhaps that part of you that does see this has, in one way or another, already come to terms with what has happened or with your situation. Perhaps, at the same time, it recognizes that your feelings still need to play themselves out, that they are not ready to accept or to calm down, and that this is all right. Profoundly healing insights may arise if you are willing to look deeply into your own emotional pain as it occurs. One major realization you might come to is the inevitability of change, the direct perception that, whether we like it or not, impermanence is in the very nature of things and relationships. If you were to look into one of our classes at the hospital, the chances are you'd find us with our eyes closed, sitting quietly or lying motionless on the floor. This can go on for anywhere from 10 minutes to 45 minutes at a stretch. To the outside observer, it might look strange, if not a little crazy. It looks like nothing's going on, and in a way, nothing is. But it is a very rich and complex nothing. These people are practicing what we call non-doing. They are actively tuning in to each moment in an effort to remain awake and aware from one moment to the next. They are practicing mindfulness. Another way to say it is that they are practicing being. For once, they are purposefully stopping all the doing in their lives and relaxing into the present without trying to fill it up with anything. Learning how to stop all your doing and shift over into a being mode, learning how to make time for yourself, how to slow down and nurture calmness and acceptance in yourself, learning to observe what your own mind is up to moment, how to watch your thoughts and how to let them go without getting so caught up and driven by them, how to make room for new ways of seeing old problems and for perceiving the interconnectedness of things. These are some of the lessons of mindfulness. This kind of learning involves settling into moments of being and cultivating awareness. The more systematically and regularly you practice, the more the power of mindfulness will grow and the more it will work for you. This audiobook is meant to serve as a map, a guide for you in this process, just as the weekly classes are a guide for the people who come to the stress reduction clinic at the urging of their doctors. As you know, a map is not the territory it portrays. In the same way, you should not mistake listening to this audiobook for the actual journey. That journey you have to live yourself by cultivating mindfulness in your own life. Until recently, the very word meditation tended to evoke raised eyebrows and thoughts about mysticism and hocus pocus in many people. In part, that was because people did not understand that meditation is really about paying attention. This is now much more widely known. And since paying attention is something that everybody does, at least occasionally, meditation is not as foreign or irrelevant to our life experience as we might once have thought. However, when we start paying attention a little more closely to the way our own mind actually works, as we do when we meditate, we are likely to find that much of the time, our mind is more in the past or the future than it is in the present. Consequently, in any moment, we may be only partially aware of what is actually occurring in the present. We can miss many of the moments in which we live because we are not fully here for them. This is true not just while we're meditating. Unawareness can dominate the mind in any moment, and consequently, it can affect virtually everything we do. We may find that much of the time we're really on automatic pilot, functioning mechanically, coasting through our lives without being fully aware of what we're doing or experiencing. You might verify for yourself whether this description applies to your own mind the next time you're driving a car. It's a very common experience to drive someplace and have little or no awareness of what you saw along the way. You may have been on automatic pilot for much of the drive, not really fully there, but there enough, one would hope, to drive safely and uneventfully. Even if you deliberately try to concentrate on a particular task, whether it's driving or something else, you might find it difficult to be in the present for very long. Ordinarily, our attention is easily distracted. The mind tends to wander. It drifts into thought and reverie. You can experience this pull of the thinking mind for yourself right now if you perform the following experiment. At some point, you might want to just pause the CD to practice on your own. Try closing your eyes and sitting so that your back is straight but not stiff, and become aware of your breathing. Don't try to control your breathing. Rather, just let it happen and become aware of it, feeling how it feels, witnessing it as it flows in and out. Try being with your breath in this way for 3 minutes. If at some point you think that it's foolish or boring to just sit here and watch your breath go in and out, note to yourself that this is just a thought, a judgment that your mind is creating. Then simply let go of it and bring your attention back to your breathing. Aside from physical discomfort and pain, there are numerous other occurrences during meditation that can carry your attention away from the breath. The primary one is thinking. Just because you decide to still your body and observe your breath from moment to moment doesn't mean that your thinking mind is going to cooperate. It doesn't quiet down just because you have decided to meditate. What does happen as we pay attention to our breathing is that we see that we live immersed in a seemingly never-ending stream of thoughts, coming willy-nilly one after another in rapid succession. In the early stages of meditation practice, the activity of thought is constantly pulling our attention away from the primary task we have set ourselves in the developing of calmness and concentration, namely, to be with the breath. In order to build continuity and momentum in the meditation practice, you will need to keep reminding yourself to come back to the breath no matter what the mind is up to from one moment to the next. If you are in a period of high stress, the mind will tend to obsess about your predicament, what you should do or should have done or shouldn't do or shouldn't have done. At such times, your thoughts may be highly charged with anxiety and worry. At less stressful times, you may find yourself thinking about a movie you saw, or fall captive to a song in your head that stubbornly refuses to leave. Or you may be thinking about dinner, or work, or your parents, or your children, or other people, or your vacation, or your health, or death, or your bills, or just about anything else. Thoughts of one kind or another will cascade through the mind as you sit, most of them below the level of your awareness, until finally you realize that you are not watching your breathing anymore, and you don't even know how long it's been since you were aware of it, nor how you got to what you are thinking now that you have woken up to the fact that the breath was forgotten. It's at this point that you say, okay, let's just go back to the breath right now and let go of the thoughts I'm having, no matter what they are. It also helps in such moments to check your posture and sit up straight again if your body is slumped over, which it commonly does when your awareness becomes dull. The Stress Reduction Clinic does not exist in a vacuum, however. It is a behavioral medicine clinic in the Department of Medicine at a major medical center. Behavioral medicine and what is now called mind-body or integrative medicine represents a new current within medicine itself, one that is rapidly expanding our ideas and knowledge about health and illness. Perhaps the most fundamental development in this area that is now called integrative medicine is the recognition that we can no longer think about health as being solely a characteristic of the body or of the mind, because mind and body are interconnected. The new perspective acknowledges the central importance of thinking in terms of wholeness and interconnectedness, and the need to pay attention to the interactions of mind, body, and behavior in efforts to understand and treat illness. Medicine is presently expanding its own working model of what health and illness are, and how lifestyle, patterns of thinking and feeling, relationships, and environmental factors all interact to influence health. The new model explicitly rejects the view that mind and body are fundamentally and inexorably separate. In its place, medicine is presently seeking to articulate an alternative, more encompassing vision for understanding what we actually mean by mind and body, health and disease. This transformation in medicine is sometimes referred to as a paradigm shift, a movement from one entire worldview to another. There is little doubt that not only medicine, but all of science is going through such a shift as the implications of the revolutionary changes in our understanding of nature and of ourselves that have come about in the 20th century and now the 21st century become clearer. For the most part, our day-to-day thinking about physical reality, that is, our tacit assumptions about the world, the body, matter, and energy, that model, that way of thinking, is based on an outmoded view of reality, one that has changed little in the past 300 years. Science is now searching for more comprehensive models that are truer to our understanding of the interconnectedness of space and time, mass and energy, mind and body, even consciousness and the universe. At this point, we will begin exploring what we mean by wholeness and interconnectedness and why they are so important for health and healing. It's hoped that the views and information that I present here will help you to develop your own view of why you might undertake to practice meditation regularly, a vision within which you can put the healing power of mindfulness to practical use in your own life. This is good news because, given a particular situation, there are usually many ways of seeing it and many potential ways of handling it. It means that the way we see, appraise, and evaluate our problems will determine how we respond to them and how much distress we will experience. It also implies that we may have much more control over things that may potentially cause us stress than we might ordinarily think. While there will always be many potential stressors in our environment over which we cannot have immediate control, by changing the way we see ourselves in relationship to them, we can actually change our experience of the relationship and therefore modify the extent to which it taxes or exceeds our resources or endangers our well-being. The transactional view of psychological stress also implies that you can be more resistant to stress if you build up your resources and enhance your physical and psychological well-being in general, via exercise and meditation, for example, during times when you're not particularly taxed or overwhelmed. The word resources really means that combination of inner and outer supports and strengths that help us to cope with a changing field of experiences. Support of family members, friends, and membership in groups that you care about are examples of external resources that could help buffer your experiences of stress. Inner resources might include your beliefs about your ability to handle adversity, your view of yourself as a person, your views on change, your religious beliefs, and your level of stress hardiness, sense of coherence, and trust. All these can be strengthened, as we've seen, by practicing mindfulness. If, on the other hand, our reactions to things are usually clouded by emotions of fear, hopelessness, or anger, or by underlying motives of greed and distrust, then our actions will more than likely create additional problems and dig us deeper into a hole, to the point where it may be hard for us to see our way out of what seems more and more overwhelming. Precisely because perception and appraisal, or the lack of them, play such a major role in our ability to adapt and respond appropriately to change and to pain and to threats to our well-being, the major avenue available to us as individuals for handling stress effectively is to understand what we are going through. We can best do this by cultivating our ability to perceive our experience in its full context. In this way, we can discern relationships and feedback that we may not have been aware of before. This allows us to see our life situation more clearly and thereby influence the level of stress associated with our habitual reactions in difficult situations. It also frees us from the tight grip of our many unconscious beliefs that ultimately inhibit our growth. So it can be particularly helpful to keep in mind from moment to moment that it is not so much the stressors in our lives, but how we see them and what we do with them that determines how much we are at their mercy. If we can change the way we see, we can change the way we respond. One of the major sources of suffering in our lives is that we usually want to have things our own way. Thus, when things happen that we like, we feel that everything is going our way and we feel happy. And when things go against us, so to speak, when they do not happen the way we want or the way we expected or planned for, then we tend to feel thwarted, frustrated, angry, wounded, unhappy, and we suffer. The irony is that often we really don't know what our way is, even though we want to have it all of the time. If we get what we want, we usually want something else in addition. The mind somehow keeps finding new things that it needs in order to feel happy or fulfilled. In this regard, it is rarely satisfied with things as they are for very long, even if things are relatively peaceful and satisfying. When little children get upset because they can't have everything they see that they would like to have, we are apt to tell them, "You can't always have your own way." And when they say, "Why not?" we say, "Because," or you'll understand when you grow up. But this is a fiction we perpetrate on them. In fact, most of the time, we grown-ups don't behave as if we understand life any better than our children do. We want to have things our own way, too. To break out of this trap of always being driven by our own desires, it's not a bad exercise to ask yourself from time to time, "What is my own way? What do I really want? Would I know it if I got it? Does everything have to be, quote, perfect right now, or under my total control right now, for me to be happy?" Alternatively, you might ask yourself, "Is everything already basically okay right now? Am I just not noticing the ways in which things are good because my mind keeps coming up with ideas for what it has to have or has to get rid of before I can be happy, just like a child?" If you practice incorporating asking yourself about your own way into your meditation practice, you will find that it is very effective in bringing you back to the present moment. You might try sitting with the question, "Right now, what is my way?" It's sufficient to ask the question. Trying to answer it isn't necessary. It's more fruitful just to ponder the question, keeping it alive from moment to moment, listening for the response from within your own heart. "What is my own way? What is my own way?" Many of the people in the stress reduction clinic rapidly discover their own way may be the life that they are actually living. What other way could be theirs? They come to see that their pain is a part of their own way too, and not necessarily an enemy. They also come to see that at least some of their emotional pain, if not most of it, comes from their own actions or inaction, and is thus potentially manageable. In seeing with eyes of wholeness, they come to realize that they are not their suffering, just as they are not their symptoms, their physical pain, or their illness. If the feeling is very strong, try the following additional experiment, which we sometimes suggest to our patients who feel similarly bored with watching their breathing. Take the thumb and first finger of either hand, clamp them tightly over your nose, keep your lips pressed together, and notice how long it takes before your breathing becomes very interesting to you. When you have completed 3 minutes of watching your breath go in and out, reflect on how you felt during this time and how much or how little your mind wandered away from your breathing. What do you think would have happened if you'd continued for 5 or 10 minutes, or for half an hour, or for an hour? For most of us, our minds tend to wander a lot and to jump quite rapidly from one thing to another. This makes it difficult to keep our attention focused on our breathing for any length of time, unless we train ourselves to stabilize and calm our own mind. This little 3-minute experiment can give you a taste of what meditation is. It is the process of observing body and mind intentionally, of letting your experiences unfold from moment to moment, and accepting them as they are. It does not involve rejecting your thoughts, nor trying to clamp down on them or suppress them, nor trying to control anything at all other than the focus and the direction of your attention. Yet it would be incorrect to think of meditation as a passive process. It takes a good deal of energy and effort to regulate your attention and to remain genuinely calm and non-reactive. But paradoxically, mindfulness does not involve trying to get anywhere or feel anything special. Rather, it involves allowing yourself to be where you already are, to become more familiar with your own actual experience moment by moment. So if you didn't feel particularly relaxed during these 3 minutes, or the thought of doing it for a half an hour is inconceivable to you, you don't need to worry. The relaxation comes by itself with continued practice. The point of this 3-minute exercise was simply to try to pay attention to your breathing and to note what actually happened when you did. If you start paying attention to where your mind is from moment to moment throughout the day, chances are you will find that considerable amounts of your time and energy are expended in clinging to memories, being absorbed in reverie, and regretting things that have already happened and are over. And you will probably find that as much or more energy is expended in anticipating, planning, worrying, and fantasizing about the future and what you want to happen or don't want to happen. Because of this inner busyness, which is going on almost all the time, we are liable either to miss a lot of the texture of our life experience or to discount its value and meaning. For example, let's say you're not too preoccupied to look at a sunset and are struck by the play of light and color among the clouds and in the sky. For that moment, you are just here with it, taking it in, really seeing it. Then thinking comes in and perhaps you find yourself saying something to a companion, either about the sunset and how beautiful it is, or about something else that it reminded you of. In speaking, you disturb the direct experiencing of that moment. You've been drawn away from the sun and the sky and the light. You've been captured by your own thought and by your impulse to voice it. Your comment breaks the silence. Or even if you don't say anything, the thought or memory that came up has already carried you away from the real sunset in that moment. So now you are really enjoying the sunset in your head rather than the sunset that is actually happening. You may be thinking you are enjoying the sunset itself, but actually you are only experiencing it through the veil of your own embellishments with past sunsets and other memories and ideas that it triggered in you. During meditation, we treat all our thoughts as if they are of equal value. We try to be aware of them when they come up, and then we intentionally return our attention to the breath as the major focus of observation, regardless of the content of the thought. In other words, we intentionally practice letting go of each thought that attracts our attention, whether it seems important and insightful or unimportant and trivial. We just observe them as thoughts, as discrete events that appear in the field of our awareness. We are aware of them because they are here already, but we intentionally decline getting caught up in the content of the thoughts during meditation, no matter how charged the content may be for us at that moment. Instead, we remind ourselves to perceive them simply as thoughts, as seemingly independently occurring events in the field of our awareness. We note their content and the amount of charge they have, in other words, whether they are weak or strong in their power to dominate the mind at that moment. Then, no matter how charged they are for us at that moment, we intentionally let go and refocus on our breathing once again and on the experience of being in our body as we sit. Letting go of our thoughts, however, does not mean suppressing them. Many people hear it this way and make the mistake of thinking that meditation requires them to shut off their thinking or their feelings. They somehow hear the instructions as meaning that if they are thinking, that is bad, and that a good meditation is one in which there is little or no thinking. So it is important to emphasize that thinking is not bad, nor is it even undesirable during meditation. What matters is whether you are aware of your thoughts and feelings during meditation and how you handle them. Trying to suppress them will only result in greater tension and frustration and more problems, not in calmness and peace. Mindfulness does not involve pushing thoughts away or walling yourself off from them to quiet your mind. We are not trying to stop our thoughts as they cascade through the mind. We are simply making room for them, observing them as thoughts, and letting them be, using the breath as our anchor or home base for observing, for reminding us to stay focused and calm. In proceeding in this way, you will find that every meditation is different. Sometimes you may feel relatively calm and relaxed and undisturbed by thoughts or strong feelings. At other times, the thoughts and feelings may be so strong and recurrent that all you can do is watch them as best you can and be with your breath as much as you can in between. Meditation is not so concerned with how much thinking is going on as it is with how much room you are making for it to take place within the field of your awareness from one moment to the next. Have you ever looked at a dog and really seen it in its total dogness? A dog is quite miraculous when you really see it. What is it? Where did it come from? Where is it going? What is it doing here? Why is it shaped the way it is? What is its view of things, of the neighborhood? What are its feelings? Children tend to think about things this way. Their vision is fresh. They see things as if for the first time, every time. Sometimes our seeing gets tired. We just see a dog. If you've seen one, you've seen them all. So we barely see it at all. We tend to see more through our thoughts and opinions than through our eyes. Our thoughts act as a kind of veil, preventing us from seeing things with fresh eyes. What comes into view is rapidly identified by the thinking, categorizing mind and quickly framed, a dog. This mind actually prevents us from seeing the dog in its fullness. It processes and categorizes the dog signal very quickly in our brain and then moves on to do the same thing to the next perception or thought. When our son was 2 years old, he wanted to know if there was a person inside our dog. It warmed my heart to see through his eyes in that moment. I knew why he was asking. Sage was a real family member. He had his rightful place. His presence was felt. He participated in the psychic space of the house. He was a complete being, as much a personality as any of the people in the family. What could I say to him? Never mind dogs. What about a bird, or a cat, or a tree, or a flower, or a rhinoceros? They are all quite miraculous. When you really look at one, you can hardly believe it exists. There it is, this perfect thing, just being what it is, complete in itself. Any imaginative child could have dreamed up a rhinoceros or an elephant or a giraffe, but they didn't get here as the product of a child's imagination. The universe is spinning these dreams. They come out of the universe, as do we. It doesn't hurt to keep this in mind on a daily basis. It might help us to be more mindful. All life is fascinating and beautiful when the veil of our routinized thinking lifts even for a moment. A little reflection on your body will easily lead you to conclude that it does wondrous things, all of which you probably take completely for granted. Our well-being depends on the integrated functioning of our sense organs and our muscles and nerves, our cells, organs, and organ systems at all times. Yet we tend not to see and think in this way, and so we forget or are ignorant of the fact that our body is truly wondrous. It is a universe in itself, consisting of more than 10 million, million, million cells, all derived from one single cell, all organized into tissues and organs and systems and structures with a built-in ability to regulate itself as a whole, to maintain internal balance and order. In a word, our bodies are undeniably self-organizing and self-healing. The concept of stress suggests that, in one way or another, we are continually faced with the necessity of adapting to all the various pressures we experience in life. Basically, this means adapting to change. If we can learn to see change as an integral part of life and not as a threat to our well-being, we will be in a much better position to cope effectively with stress. The meditation practice itself brings us face to face with the undeniable experience of continual change within our own minds and bodies as we watch our constantly changing thoughts, feelings, sensations, perceptions, and impulses. This alone should be enough to demonstrate to us that we live immersed in a sea of change, that whatever we choose to focus on changes from one moment to the next, it comes and it goes. If we consider the major forces that impinge on our lives, the first thing we will have to acknowledge is that nothing is absolutely stable, even when our lives seem to be on a so-called even keel. Just being alive means being in a continual state of flux. We, too, evolve. Consider just the physical changes we go through. During our lives, the body itself is constantly changing. In fact, nothing at all is permanent and eternal, although some things appear that way since they are changing so slowly. In the 1960s, researchers began to investigate whether there was a relationship between how much change a person goes through in a year and what happens to his or her health at later times. Doctors Thomas Holmes and Richard Ray of the University of Washington Medical School listed a number of life changes, including the death of a spouse, divorce, imprisonment, personal injury or illness, getting married, getting fired from work, retirement, pregnancy, sexual problems, death of a family member or close friend, change in line of work or work responsibilities, taking out a mortgage, outstanding personal achievement, change in living conditions, change of personal habits, going on vacation, and even getting a traffic ticket. They ordered these so-called life events in terms of what they thought was the degree of adjustment they would require and gave them arbitrary numerical values, starting with 100 for death of a spouse and going down to 11 for a minor violation of the law. They found that a high score on their life change index was associated with a higher probability of illness in the following year than a low score. This suggested that change itself could predispose a person to illness. Many of the life changes on their list, such as getting married, getting promoted, or having an outstanding personal achievement, are usually considered happy occasions. They are included because even events that may appear positive are nevertheless profound life changes that require adaptation and are therefore stressful. Whether they later lead to distress depends in large measure on how you adapt to them. If you adjust easily, then this good stress is relatively harmless and benign. But it is all too easy to see how a positive life change might turn from good stress to distress if you have a hard time adjusting to your new circumstances. For instance, you may have been looking forward to retirement for years and be happy at first when it comes and you can finally stop getting up early and going to work.